Last week we talked about the reaching out of God to the Gentile world after having first made known His will and His name through the children of Israel. But the children of Israel were not the exclusive, did not then have the exclusive right to God. He pointed that out as He began to reach out the Gentiles. But not only was He already in His mind planning to reach out to the Gentiles, but in some respects He had to turn away from Israel in that process of reaching out to them. So you see, He, on the one hand, reached out to the Gentiles, which He would have done anyway, but on the other hand, had to turn away from His people who had bartered His presence for their own self-interest. And that's what the point that we have been stressing with you is, that we do have the access to God today. We do have His ear. At the same time, I spoke of the practical application of that in terms of our own relationships, our own friendships. We must be careful not to barter friendships too cheaply. In that respect, I would like to share with you just a moment of something that I've been really doing a lot of thinking about and writing about this very week on the subject of human friendships. We do sometimes have confusion over what is in the flesh and what is in the spirit. And sometimes people talk about relationships in the flesh as though they were not possible or not right for the believer to have. Sometimes people spiritualize things too much and shun interaction with people on the human level, the natural level. Or sometimes, on the other hand, people may be too much in the flesh in their relationships to one another. That the flesh area is a very tricky area. When we talk about natural friendships or human relationships, we have to ask, what part do these relationships have in the body of believers? That is, as people that are in the spirit. And that takes a lot of unfolding here. I may then therefore be appear to you to be departing from the matter of redemption in Isaiah, but I'm really not. I would like to lift that matter out for you, though, the relationship between the flesh and the spirit in terms of human friendships. And in terms, of course, of our relationship to Jesus Christ. The Bible uses the word flesh in several ways. It may speak of the flesh in terms of the physical body or being. It may speak of the flesh in terms of the natural human functions, the mental action, the will, the emotion. Or it may refer to the flesh as something more unwholesome than that. That is something as, for example, the phrase, the lust of the flesh. Now, that phrase is probably probably mistranslated with the word lust. It should be strong desires of the flesh, but the Bible does indicate that sometimes the desires of the flesh are unwholesome. So whenever we mention the word flesh, you must not assume that it is something automatically wrong or out of order. Paul draws a distinction between flesh and spirit in Romans 8, in which he shows that there, whose whole life is in the flesh, but if that is true, that they are not of God at all. Now, I have to really be careful here to help you. In Romans 8, Paul is not drawing a distinction between good Christians and bad Christians. He's not drawing this distinction between spiritual people and fleshly people among Christians. Because he says in Romans 8:9, the flesh is enmity against God, and if anyone is in the flesh in that sense, they do not have the Spirit of God in them. If any man have not the Spirit of Christ, he's none of his. The classification in Romans 8, called kata sarx, according to the flesh or in the flesh, means those whose whole life is in the natural and they do not have the Spirit of Christ in them at all, as contrasted with those who have the Spirit of Christ and therefore belong to Him. So you must forever abandon the thought that in Romans 8 we're talking about good Christians and bad Christians. Now, sometimes people use the word carnal wrongfully to mean Christian people that do bad things or unholy things. And so people talk about carnal Christians, a totally inadequate delineation. That's a classification that you also have to abandon immediately. Paul speaks in 1 Corinthians 3 about Christians who are sarkikos, that is, Christians who are conducting themselves in the ways that non-Christians do in the sense of strife and division. He says you are acting like the people that don't have the Spirit of Christ in them. He's not talking about people who are doing wrong things or having too much pleasure or something like that. As we may say, worldly people, meaning people that have certain pleasures that may appear to us to be a little bit on the unholy side. All right, so this word carnal, though, is the same word as the word flesh. So you see, Paul uses that flesh in different ways, but one of the ways that is clearly defined in Romans 8 is a sense in which those who are strictly natural people, strictly natural beings, and have not been touched with the Spirit of Christ are in a separate category from those that have been touched with the Spirit of Christ. And Paul says the flesh is enmity against God. In that sense, the natural person, as he says in 1 Corinthians 2:14, the natural man does not receive the things of the Spirit, neither can he know them, for they're spiritually discerned. In other words, there's no way that you can really know the things of God unless His Spirit comes to open your heart. One might say, well, that's a little unfair, isn't it? Then God is to blame if we don't know the truth. And that is not quite correct. There seems to be the need of an individual turning toward God, in which case God turns toward him. In other words, while we can never save ourselves and can never by our own action know God, there is the need of the human being to turn to God, to turn toward him. To say, look, I need help. That's all he has to do is give his cry for help. He can't know God in the flesh, that is by his natural mind, but he can ask for help through his natural mind. And the Spirit of God does have ways of helping people to see that they need help. If you're praying for a believer, you're praying for an unbeliever, somebody that is in your family or among your acquaintances, and you want the Lord to help them come to faith, one of the things he may do is to sort of pull the rug on them so they'll realize how much they need his help. I talk to people who seem to me to indicate that they don't need the Lord at all. That is, they try to put on that front at least, that they don't need any help. They can handle most of their problems. Had one person say to me, well, I can really handle, I'd say about 99% of my problems I can handle pretty well. Maybe for that extra 1% I might need some help from God. You say, well, that's a rather bold statement. That kind of person is in a position where it may be the Lord has to reveal to him his weakness before he will come to help. That's, of course, what Jesus said to the Pharisees. He said, because you think you see, I can't help you. You're blind. Because you think you are well and do not need a physician, I can't help you. It's only those that know they're blind and know they're in need of a physician that I can really give some help to. Those that know they're not righteous but unholy, if it takes a lifetime for you to learn that in your natural person you have a lot of problems, then it's a life well lived. That's maybe the best thing we can learn in our entire lifetime, is that we're all children and fools. Well, anyway, this has to do then with the idea of the natural mind being unable to really grasp the things of God. So God has got to touch them. Well, therefore, Paul says, the people that have only their natural minds to rely on cannot please God. He that is in the flesh cannot please God. That is, he that has relied on his natural mind, it takes the power of God's Spirit to change us. And even those changes, I've observed this over a great many years of ministry, the changes that take place in people do not usually take place because of simply learning some new rule and following it. In other words, I doubt very much if you will come into this place on Sunday morning and learn a lot of new things and go out immediately to practice them. You may come to understand how much more you need of help by coming here on Sunday morning. But I doubt if you really have the confidence to feel or the experience of success to go out of here and say, well, I'm going to now change everything and do everything differently. But we observe that over the period of many years, the Spirit of Christ does some changing. In a sense, I am putting food on the table for you when you come to listen to the Word. You are eating. You are being nourished in the Word. That would be just as absurd for me to try to shape your lives and be the architect of your spirits as it would for your mothers to be the architects of your body just because they put meat and potatoes on the table. I talked to a person last night who was quite concerned about the matter of church growth. How do we get more people in the church and so forth? And I said to him, there's no substitute for putting food on the table. That the pastor has got to give people something to eat. You've got to give them the Word. If he gives them the Word, they'll come back again. But for him to get up in the pulpit and try to talk people into getting people into the church, that's a pretty thin diet. But that's a common diet. How to get going for Jesus when we got to get the energy to get going with. We got to get the food in us. And if Sunday morning fare is rules and regulations and methods and manuals on how to be a good worker for Jesus, you're going to run out of steam because you're not going to have any food in your system to grow on. Now we feel, and as I told him, I said the best thing to do is to give people a reason to come back or a reason to bring their friends. You don't need to worry about getting people in if you give them something to come for. This is quite a new thing because they had been visiting some very large churches and very well-known ones that had some very fascinating techniques for getting people in. But I've heard some of the sermons from the quarters that he's talking about, and I'm not sure that if they got in there, they have that much to stay for. Anyway, the flesh, the natural man, cannot bring about growth in itself. It takes the Spirit of Christ acting through the Word, acting through the interaction of His Spirit as we come together to bring about growth. Now, why am I going into all this? Because I'm showing you an aspect of the use of the word flesh that has to do with the natural man. And I'm talking about Paul's usage of it in the one sense to refer to people that are not filled with the Spirit, that is, people who do not have the Spirit of Christ in them, therefore are not saved. I do not mean to distinguish between people filled with the Spirit and people who are saved but not filled with the Spirit. You can't be saved without having the Spirit in you. We've got a lot of artificial designations that cause people to be confused about that. If the Holy Spirit is in your heart, He's in your heart. If He's in your heart, you're saved. If He's in your heart, He's functioning with you. And to try to gauge less or more quantities of spirit in terms of commitments as unrewarding tasks. All right, so there's that usage. There is a sense, a usage of the natural processes of the flesh, where we have to undergo normal human emotions and reactions. For example, Paul in 2 Corinthians 7 says, without were fightings, within were fears. Nevertheless, God that comforteth those that are in any trouble comforted us by the coming of Titus. That opens up a whole new reach here. Here is a natural human process where there is distress within, but obviously not distress in the spirit. It's distress in the natural mind. It's anxiety or fightings, as he says, or fears, rather, in his natural mind. Now, the Lord sent Titus to comfort him. I am sure that the relationship between Titus and Paul was something ordered of God. It was a relationship that was based in the Spirit, rooted in the Spirit. But it was expressed in the flesh, in the natural. Now, if we use flesh in the sense of the natural process, we have to understand that that is part of it. The flesh is weak. Jesus said that. The Spirit is willing, but the flesh is weak. We have a natural person that we have to deal with, which Paul talks about in the 7th chapter of Romans. And he draws a distinction there between that which is possible in the Spirit and that which is a problem in the flesh. And Jesus drew the same distinction. The natural man has his weaknesses. In fact, in Romans, Second Corinthians 12:9, Paul says, speaking of a thorn in the flesh, which was giving him trouble. Now we immediately might say, well, how can Paul talk about thorns in the flesh? I thought he was rid of his flesh. No, he's not rid of his flesh. He's his natural man. He's going to keep it all the time he's on the earth. So there is that thorn in the flesh, and he prayed that the Lord would take it away. We'll not speculate at this point as to what that thorn in the flesh was. But whatever it was a human weakness. And Paul wanted God to remove it. But he said that the response he got was from the Lord was, my grace is sufficient for you, for my strength is made perfect in weakness. Paul said, most gladly, therefore, will I rather glory in my weaknesses, that the power of God may rest upon me. He goes on to say, I take pleasures in necessities and weaknesses, for when I am weak, then am I strong. When he is totally aware of his weaknesses in the flesh, then he is in a position to trust the strength of the Spirit of Christ, or to rely upon the Spirit of Christ within him for strength. When you are totally weak, you may find that some of the greatest moments you've had in your relationship to Christ have come in periods of time when you felt the weakest and the least worthy. At least I've seen that many times in my own experience. Perhaps you have too. So we recognize then that there is a point at which we express what is a spiritual quality. Now, Paul did say that I no longer know ones in the flesh, I know them in the spirit. Now, to say I know someone in the spirit, rather than knowing them in the flesh, is a different thing than to say I relate to them in the spirit and not in the flesh. There is no way that we human beings can really know one another in the fleshly sense. That's where many marriages fall apart, because people try to figure each other out in the flesh, and it just can't be done. There's no way you can rely on another person's psyche to be what you think it is or to be constant in what it may have been in the beginning. Well, the natural person, the mind, of course, again, this natural man, this natural flesh, is made up of our brain and nervous system as well as the physical functions. And whatever's in that skull of yours or under that skull cap is there because of years and years of experience and of the acquisition of data and whatnot. So here is this great mass of information that is part of your cortex, nerve paths on the cortex, and you behave yourselves, generally speaking, in terms of those nerve paths. Habits, knowledge, or lack thereof, and so forth, that make up your human psyche or your human personality. Now, for one human being to try to relate to another human being on the basis of what they know of that person in the flesh is impossible. We think we know things about people, and then we find to our chagrin that we didn't know them at all. We may base our whole relationship on what we think a person is like, and then we find out to our distress that we have been going down the wrong road with it. We've missed a cue somewhere, and we're relating to them wrongly because we missed a cue. We thought that this is the way they were, and they were not that way at all. They were some other way. Now, that's why Paul says, I do not know anyone in the flesh anymore, because of the inadequacy of the human flesh to know one another. So then what? Well, then we have to relate in the spirit in that sense. We come together with one another, not believing that we have the power to ever really do well in our relationships. Human relationships are a professional thing with me. Not only in training, but in experience for, as you know, over 30 years. For 40 years I've been training it. I mean, it started training that many years ago, practically. So, human relationships are a specialty for me. In psychology, behavioral science, all the various disciplines, plus the experience of counseling, plus my own personal experiences. Now, to this very day, I am no more adequate to really know a person in the flesh than you are. To this very day, I can make mistakes in the flesh relating to people as you can. And to the day I die, there will be trouble in the human relationships. There will be difficulty in human relationships. We'll misjudge people. We'll misread them. We'll think we know them and we don't. And if we know them, we'll think we ought to relate to them in a certain way, and that'll be the wrong way to go. So what? Then we have to rely on the Holy Spirit. And then we have to just relate to people and say, now, Lord, you're just going to have to help this relationship to be what you want it to be. Now, however, if we know another in the Spirit, yet the way we have to express that is in the flesh, in the natural. You can't sit across the room and just say to somebody, be warmed and fed and comforted, God bless you, brother, and go your way. You know. Or shoot a prayer up, now, Lord, you comfort so-and-so. Well, you know, and he may say to you, well, you comfort him. How do I know that? Because in 2 Corinthians 1, 3, and 4, Paul talks about that subject, and he speaks of the God of all, the Father of mercies and the God of all comfort, who comforts us in our tribulations, that we may be able to comfort others with the same comfort wherewith we ourselves are comforted of God. So the Lord gives us human experiences, or allows us human experiences, to be able to reach out and help somebody else. Now, there are many different ways to comfort people. Sometimes you have to comfort them by telling the truth. I very often have to do that. I have to say some pretty hard things sometimes to people. But it turns out to be a comfort to them, because it changes the course of things, and they get their feet under them. To comfort one, you don't always have to go up and throw your arms around them. In fact, there's probably a lot more of that in the church than should be. People get into that fleshly thing of expecting that their whole relationship to one another should be expressed that way, and I think that that's very, very risky, very risky, and directs us away from the true comfort. But that doesn't keep you from sitting down with a brother or a sister and empathizing with them, weeping with them. Jesus had to go through natural human relationships to be able to understand the human hearts. He understands our human relationships. He went through it himself. He did not stand aloof on the basis of, oh, well, it's going to work out all right. What are you crying for? You know, a lot of people like that. So, they come to these troubles and they say, oh, praise God, it's all right. You know, but there's a, you begin to wonder if they care. We have natural human emotions that we can't really wipe out lest we just become hard-shelled people. The Lord lets us go through times of deep distress to keep us from becoming hard-shelled people. For we are only relating to others on a theological basis. Now, I want you to see this distinction between a relationship that is rooted in the Spirit and expressed in the flesh versus a relationship that is rooted in the flesh and expressed in the flesh. If you did not understand this, you might be confused about how to relate to people and feel that any kind of feelings or emotions were wrong, and that's not true. We live on the earth. We weep. We are told to weep with those that weep and rejoice with those that rejoice. We can't have crocodile tears. To really be able to sensitively deal with people, you almost have to be plowed up pretty much yourself. Then you're sensitive to the human thing. Otherwise, we become sterile. And if you've ever had the experience of having a deep burden on your heart, and you go and talk to someone who is apparently pretty spiritual, and they sort of pass it all off by saying, oh, well, you shouldn't cry, you shouldn't be worried, Jesus will take care of it all. But there's no comfort in that. There's no help in that. I have to say to you, no matter what you may think in your head about how you ought to feel, you don't always feel that way. You can argue with yourself about it all day and say, no, you mustn't feel that way, and you're going to feel that way anyway. Sometimes it just takes a word of comfort from a brother or a sister to help you. So we have that thing of being sensitive to one another. It's just like the same thing when you had some problem and you talk to a friend about it, and their response is always, oh, well, I had a bigger problem myself, you know. And you say, well, I just had an operation for appendicitis, and their response is always, oh, well, I had one for gallbladder, so we're in the same boat. You say, well, always trying to upstage you, you see. People don't want to be upstaged. They don't want a sermon. Somebody, if a brother or a sister is hurting, they don't want a sermon from you. They want somebody to care. You can go through a lot of things if you know somebody cares. You say, well, that's fleshy. Of course it's fleshy, because we're still in the flesh. But God did not set up a spiritual society in which all our needs are met in a spiritual level, in the sense that we never have to communicate with people in the natural realm. That would be like living in air castles. There are a lot of Christians who do. They become indifferent or callous to the feelings of people around them whilst they live in the stratosphere on cloud nine and feel very superior, incidentally, I may say, because they never feel worried or hurt or care, and they feel that's because they're so spiritual, maybe just because they're so selfish. And if they're in that condition and the Lord is working with them, he's liable to plow them up a lot to get them in a position where they can feel for people. I want you to understand it is not wrong to feel things in the natural emotion. God created this body the way it is. It's not wrong to feel. It is wrong to put your weight on those feelings, because that'll get you into trouble. You can love people and care about people and feel for people, but if all your weight is on that relationship, you're going to get let down. Your strength is in the Spirit. If you relate to people and live a life of caring and sharing with them, and yet your trust and dependence is in Christ, then you're in a pretty good situation. Then you will be like Jesus was on the earth. Now, we're not. Jesus is more than we can ever be in the sense that he took upon him the nature of man before the fall. So there were some things about Jesus that are not true of us. On the other hand, the human emotional range was there. He didn't sin, but the human emotional range was there. He wept with those that wept and rejoiced with those that rejoiced. He sat over the city of Jerusalem and wept. Oh, Jerusalem, he says, how often I would have gathered you under my wings as a mother hen gathers her chickens, and you would not. He did not sit up there and look down his nose at him and say, well, you hard-headed people, you deserve all you get because you've been turning away from God and all of that. So not an uncommon thing among believers. How often we can look at somebody and say, well, he deserved it after all. Don't feel sorry for him. But Jesus wept over these people that had stoned the prophets and blasphemed his Father and would soon put him to the cross. When he saw the multitudes in the ninth chapter of Matthew, the 36th verse, he saw these multitudes he was ministering to, and it was right at the time he was going to feed them. And he looked at them, and it said, the scripture says he had compassion on them because they were as sheep without a shepherd. In fact, the Greek words are very strong there. He saw them as beat down and pursued. Actually, the Greek word means flayed and pursued. Battered and bruised and pursued as sheep without a shepherd. And he had compassion. And what did he do with them? He fed them. His capacity to do that was rooted in the Spirit. Your capacity and mine will be only in the Spirit to do that. All of this emerging out of something in Isaiah. The children of Israel lightly treated their covenant with God and bartered it for idols of stone and for the pleasures and fascinations of the natural flesh. So God turned to the Gentiles. As the Spirit of Christ works in your spirit, he will help you to relate properly to people. He will help you to have a sixth sense about what people really are rather than what they appear to be on the surface, and you will be more able to understand in the Spirit. But that understanding in the Spirit and that power in the Spirit to relate to people must eventually be expressed in the flesh, that is, in the natural realm. The Lord will not let you shut yourself off from people and just go to glory, six sheets to the wind, caring not for anybody else beside you. He's going to drive you into relationship with people if he's going to make real in your heart the implications of the Spirit that is within him and within you. But by all means, don't depend on these human relationships for your strength or your peace of mind, because you're going to be in trouble if you do. On the other hand, it is well if they can depend on you. It seems like a paradox, but be a dependable person in your relationship to others as much as lies in you. Just as Paul said, as much as lies in you, be at peace with people. He didn't let people have just a free trip that because they're spiritual, they don't have to worry about what they say to anybody, that the peace comes automatically. No, he says, as much as lies in you, live peaceably with people. So there is something for us to do in reaching out to others.